is Maytag Month, and Menards is passing the savings on to you. You need reliable and energy-efficient appliances to conquer the day. Menards is your one-stop shop with appliances in stock and ready to take home today. Check out our top appliance brands, including KitchenAid, Maytag, Whirlpool, Amana, and Criterion. Save big money on Maytag appliances at Menards. And check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now.
Save big money at Menards.
This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
Welcome back to our conversation, digging into the history and the story and the accusations that have existed for decades against Michael Jackson. This is part three. He was a little kid from Brisbane, 7 years old. He could dance like nobody else's age. And when he won a Michael Jackson dance contest in Australia, the cameras couldn't get enough of him. Michael Jackson couldn't get enough of him either. Within a few years, Wade Robson's mother had moved the family to Los Angeles. At Jackson's encouragement, the boy was in Jackson's orbit, in his home, in his studio, in his bed, by his own later admission, dozens of times. In 1993, when the first allegations hit, 10-year-old Wade went on television and said Michael Jackson had never done anything wrong. In 2005, Wade Robson, now a grown man, a successful choreographer, someone who had built an entire career on the talent Jackson helped nurture, sat in a witness chair and told a jury under oath that nothing happened. He was composed. He was convincing. He helped acquit the most famous defendant in America. And then, 4 years after Michael Jackson was put in the ground, Wade Robson filed a lawsuit claiming that every word he'd spoken under oath was a lie. That Jackson had essayed him for years, beginning when he was seven. That he'd been too shattered, too conditioned, too broken by the experience to even recognize it as abuse until his mind and body finally gave out. This is part four in our series. This is the episode that asks you to hold two contradictory ideas in your head at the same time, because the evidence supports both and the truth might live in the tension between them. James Safechuck's entry into Jackson's world happened through a Pepsi commercial. He was 10 years old when he appeared alongside Jackson in the ad. After it aired, according to Safechuck, Jackson began pursuing a relationship with the boy and his family. Phone calls, visits, vacations, gifts. Safechuck says Jackson gave him the jacket from the Thriller video. He says Jackson flew his family to Neverland, to concerts, to international destinations. And he says that all of this began during a trip to Hawaii when Jackson asked the boy to sleep in his bed. According to Safechuck, what followed was years of escalating ass contact that Jackson framed as love. Safechuck alleges Jackson held a mock wedding ceremony with him, gave him a ring, told him the relationship was romantic. And then, according to Safechuck, Jackson replaced him, moved on to younger boys as Safechuck grew older. Safechuck says he defended Jackson during the 1993 investigation as a child because he genuinely believed what Jackson told him, that their relationship was special and that speaking about it would destroy them both. I mean, this is how predators operate. In 2013, Wade Robson appeared on the Today Show and publicly accused Jackson for the first time. He filed a lawsuit reportedly seeking damages from Jackson's business entities. James Safechuck watched that interview and says it broke something open inside of him. He then filed his own lawsuit in 2014 alleging abuse from the age of 10 over a period of several years. Both men had previously testified, Safechuck as a child during the 1993 investigation, Robson as an adult in the 2005 trial, that Jackson never did any of that to him. Both were now saying the opposite. The lawsuits were initially dismissed. Timing was the issue. The court said they'd been filed too late. Then California changed its statute of limitations for childhood claims like this. And both suits were reviewed on appeal. The cases were consolidated. And as of the recording of this episode, a civil trial is still scheduled for later this year, with the men reportedly seeking $400 million from Jackson's estate and business entities. The estate has denied all allegations and called the claims financially motivated. In 2019, filmmaker Dan Reed released Leaving Neverland on HBO. The four-hour documentary consisted almost entirely of Robson and Safechuck sitting in front of cameras and describing in graphic detail what they say Michael Jackson did to them as children. Their mothers appeared as well, describing their own guilt, their own failure to see what they now believe was happening. Dre Robson broke down, recounting how she left her seven-year-old son alone with a grown man she barely knew, because the grown man was Michael Jackson. And how the fame, the access, the impossible glamour of it all made her override every instinct a parent is supposed to have. If these women are telling the truth, they have to live with the knowledge that they handed their children to a predator and smiled while they did it. That kind of guilt doesn't need a lawsuit to be real. The documentary was devastating. It won an Emmy. Radio stations pulled Jackson's music for a time. The Simpsons removed an episode featuring his voice for a brief period. It seemed like the reckoning might be permanent. It wasn't. Jackson's streaming numbers recovered. MJ the Musical opened on Broadway, and strong ticket sales ensued. The Jackson estate sued HBO for what was reportedly $100 million, claiming the network had violated a non-disparagement clause from a 1992 contract. After rounds of appeals, the estate and HBO reached a settlement, and the documentary was pulled from the platform. As of the recording, the series Leaving Neverland is not available on any major streaming service. A sequel focused on the legal battle was released on YouTube in early 2025. Now, here's where intellectual honesty requires us to acknowledge the factual problems with the accusers' accounts, because they're real too, and pretending they don't exist would be dishonest. I'm not here to tell you don't believe them. I'm here to just present it all, like I've said, and you make your own judgments. Safechuck claimed he was abused at Neverland's train station at multiple points between 1988 and 1992. A Jackson biographer documented that the train station wasn't built until 1994, when Safechuck would have been at least 16. The documentary's director acknowledged the discrepancy and argued that Safechuck simply got the timeline wrong, and that the abuse happened, but not on the dates he remembered or the place. An explanation is plausible. Trauma is well documented to scramble timelines and specific details, but it's also the kind of factual error that gives skeptics a legitimate foothold. If the location and the dates don't align, what else might not align? Robson testified under oath, not once but twice, that Michael Jackson never did anything. He directly refuted a former maid's testimony that she had witnessed Jackson showering with him. If Robson is telling the truth now, he committed perjury in a criminal trial. That's not a minor detail. That's a man looking at a jury and deliberately lying to protect the person he now says did these things. Robson's supporters say that's consistent with grooming, that victims frequently protect their abusers, sometimes for decades. And that's true too. Robson's detractors say he lied, and he's lying now. And the only thing that changed was the opportunity to access a fortune. Both lawsuits were initially thrown out as untimely and only reviewed when the law changed. The estate points to this as evidence that the claims lack merit. Robson and Safechuck waited strategically, watching the legal landscape, and only came forward when the statute of limitations shifted in their favor. Supporters argue that changes to statutes of limitations exist specifically because childhood victims often take decades to come forward, and that penalizing them for the delay is penalizing them for the very damage the abuse caused. This is where the episode needs to go. Somewhere that most coverage doesn't. And to the psychology itself. Because the question right now everybody should be asking isn't about legal timelines or train station construction dates. The question is, how do you explain someone defending their abuser under oath for years and then completely reversing? And I think, you know, you can. And you can argue that it really raises a lot of credibility issues, too. Trauma experts who study childhood abuse will tell you this. It is entirely consistent for victims to defend their abusers well into adulthood. The mechanisms are well documented. Grooming creates emotional dependency. The abuser positions himself as the protector, the mentor, someone the child loves. The contact is normalized within the relationship. The abuser frames it as affection, as something special, as something that must be kept secret, not because it's wrong, but because the world wouldn't understand. The child internalizes this framework. They don't have a reference point for what's normal, because their normal was defined by the abuser. As a child grows into an adult, the defense mechanisms stay in place. Compartmentalization, denial, loyalty, the abuse becomes a locked room in the mind, something that's there but that the person has no language to access or confront. And then something breaks the seal, a triggering event, a breakdown, a child of their own reaching the age they were when it started. Robson reported suffering two nervous breakdowns, one in April 2011, another in March of 2012, before filing his lawsuit in 2013. Safechuck says he didn't recognize his experience as abuse until he watched Robson speaking publicly. Researchers who reviewed the behavior patterns described the leaving in that they described in leaving Neverland as without taking a position on whether these specific allegations are true, noted that the described dynamics are consistent with established grooming models. The lavish gifts, the insertion into the family, the isolation from parents, the escalation, the replacement with younger children, the secrecy maintained through emotional manipulation rather than threats. These aren't random. They follow a pattern that's been documented across thousands of cases. But this is the part that makes it so agonizing. The existence of a recognizable pattern doesn't prove the specific allegations are true. It means the described behavior is consistent with. It doesn't mean it actually occurred. A pattern can be genuine or a pattern can be borrowed. A person who wanted to fabricate a convincing allegation would describe exactly the same dynamics that a genuine victim would describe. If you know the pattern to describe, you can make it up. You can make it sound very real. The pattern validates the possibility. It doesn't confirm the reality. So where does that leave us? The two men who say they were destroyed by Michael Jackson and spent decades unable to face it, and a legal system that's about to test those claims in court for the first time. That trial, like I said, scheduled for later this year, will be the first occasion where Robson and Safechuck present their full case in an adversarial setting, with cross-examination, with documented evidence, with the estate's attorneys challenging every detail. It may produce answers. It may produce a verdict that one side celebrates and the other dismisses. It may produce more ambiguity. Here's a question I want to leave you with, and the one that doesn't have a comfortable answer. Does the financial motive eliminate the possibility that abuse occurred? Because those two things aren't mutually exclusive. A person can be genuinely traumatized and also want compensation. Pursuing a lawsuit doesn't prove someone is lying. It also doesn't prove they're telling the truth. The financial motive doesn't erase the trauma, and the trauma doesn't erase the financial motive. They coexist, and sitting with that coexistence is deeply uncomfortable. If Robson and Safechuck are telling the truth, then Michael Jackson abused children for decades while the legal system, the entertainment industry, and the public looked the other way. And those same institutions are still looking the other way, funding biopics, filling Broadway theaters, and pulling the documentary off streaming platforms. If they're lying, the dead man is being accused by people who committed perjury, manipulated the legal system, and are trying to extract a fortune from an estate that belongs to his children. And the cultural cost of false allegations, the damage to every real survivor who has to fight for credibility, would be incalculable. Both of those possibilities are real, and the stakes are human either way. Next, we go to the family that just broke open, the Casillos, the people who sat on Oprah's couch and defended Michael Jackson, who published a book praising him, who accepted millions in settlement money, and who just filed a federal lawsuit claiming him a serial. Yeah. We're going to get to that next. Be sure to press subscribe so you don't miss any of our discussions on this case. And in many cases, we follow for you right here. The links are in the description. Love for you to weigh in and give us your thoughts. Until next time, my name's Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.